I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In a new book, former CIA and NSA director General Michael Hayden cites what he calls Donald Trump's glandular aversion to mounting a defense against Russian attacks on the fabric of American democracy. Hayden suggests that this is a symptom of a larger problem, the purposeful abandonment of truth and facts as the basis for decision-making. Beginning with a transition that included hardly any detailed briefings on geopolitical issues, Hayden laments that the chasm between the judgment of the intelligence community and the government's response has never been larger or more dangerous. General Michael Hayden is my guest today to talk about the assault on intelligence, American national security in an age of lies. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It is, in fact, midday. I'm Tom Hall and very, very glad that you're with us. My guest today is General Michael Hayden. In more than 40 years in the Air Force and the intelligence community, the retired four-star general served as the director of the National Security Agency from 1999 to 2005 during the George W. Bush administration. He also served for about a year as the principal deputy director of national intelligence, and in 2006, he became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency until President Obama appointed Leon Panetta to that position in 2009. The thesis of General Hayden's latest book is disconcerting and frightening, to say the least. Given President Trump's proclivity to lie about what he knows to be true and the danger that there are things he should know to be true but doesn't, Michael Hayden paints a picture of an intelligence community at risk whose efficacy is directly affected by the president's refusal to acknowledge facts and his harsh and undisciplined rhetoric. If the intelligence community cannot effectively do its job, then the country is at risk, as are the basic institutions that make up our democracy. General Hayden is no stranger himself to controversies surrounding intelligence. It was under his watch at the NSA during the Bush administration that reports surfaced of warrantless wiretapping of Americans in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. His book is about the importance of truth-telling, an abiding responsibility of the intelligence community when it educates the president about the geopolitical landscape and the options that the commander-in-chief may consider to address a range of challenges. The book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. General Michael Hayden joins me from the studios of NPR in Washington. General, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom, and great summary, by the way.
Well, I appreciate that. It was a disconcerting and unsettling experience to read this book. As I mentioned, you've got more than 40 years experience in the Air Force and in the intelligence community, and you write towards the end of the book, you say, speaking about the country, if this is who we are or who we are becoming, I have wasted 40 years of my life. Until now, it was not possible for me to conceive of an American president capable of such an outrageous assault on truth, a free press, or the First Amendment. You are really sounding a clarion call here for what exactly?
Well, that particular quote is tied directly to the president's attack on the press, saying that it is the enemy of the American people. And I have experienced in my professional life how people who would trend towards autocracy want to destroy or invalidate those institutions that actually have the capability to push back. So, Tom, you're right. The whole core of the book is the question of truth. And the fact, and although I talk a lot about the president, and you've just talked a lot about the president, the core of the book begins with a shift in our political culture that makes the president effect, not cause, that we have shifted into what the Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year for 2016, post-truth. The Oxford Dictionary defines it as decision-making based less on data, evidence, and proof, and more on feelings, emotion, preference, tribe, loyalty, and grievance. And I fear the president not only reflects that mode of decision making, but actually has made it worse within the broader society by a lot of what he does and really a lot of what he says.
And that litany you just listed sounds like the way we vote. You know,
well,
there's been a lot of talk about, you know, with this terrible situation at the southern border now and children being ripped from the arms of their parents, people saying this is not who we are. This is not America. But I wonder, maybe this is exactly who we are. I mean, we elected Mr. Trump, the president of the United States. There were 63 or 4 million people who voted for him. There were 70 million people who didn't vote for anybody, who just sat it out and didn't care enough to vote for or against him. Maybe this is exactly who we are.
So let the record show that 9 million people voted for, more people voted for someone else. All right. So the president is a minority president, but legitimately president. I do not question that premise at all, Tom. But you reflect the quote you lifted from the book. If this is who we are, or if this is who we are becoming, then I feel as if the republic that I spent my life defending, the idea of America that I spent a lot of my life defending, has shifted on me, and hence the warning, the sense of sadness, the sense of disappointment. I mean, look, we are, I think, at base. By the way, Tom, I hope you enjoyed reading the book. I really enjoyed writing it because I got outside of my circle, and if you have gone through the book, you'll see I talk to philosophers and historians and technicians and people in the back room of a bar in Pittsburgh to better understand everyone's views. And I've always identified, and I think we have always identified ourselves as a creedal nation, a nation that is united only by that in which we believe. You know, how do you get to be an American? Read the document, prove you understand the document, swear to the document, you're in, just like everyone else. And that seems to be shifting in the direction of our identifying ourselves more by blood, soil, and shared history. That's a big deal. That's a big difference. And it's a re-identification of our core if it's taking place.
Here's a quote, General, from this is Mr. Trump speaking in one of his very first press conferences right after he was elected.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do.
And of course, that comment by the president, got an awful lot of pushback. And you yourself invoked the Nazis just this weekend with a tweet concerning the similarities that you found between how the Nazis treated families and how the U.S. government is treating them on the border with Mexico.
Yeah. So to begin at the beginning with the president's comment, that was on the Steele dossier becoming public. All right. And there's so much incorrect in what the president had said up to and including calling intelligence professionals Nazis. But Tom, the Steele dossier had been circulating in Washington for most of the late summer and fall of 2016. I'm out of government, you know, at that point by almost 8 years. And I have people buying me breakfast to ask me what it is I know about the Steele dossier and newsmen. And they're telling me what they've heard is in the Steele dossier. So this is not the intelligence community leaking a classified document. This is a document that had already been making the rounds, and about which, out of a sense of a duty to warn, the intel guys on 6th January left Jim Comey behind in the room to let the president know that if he did not yet know, this is out there and he needed to be aware of it.
And speaking of Mr. Comey, the IG's report, the Inspector General of the FBI, had a very scathing critique of Mr. Comey's handling of the email situation with Secretary Clinton. Does that not feed the fire? I mean, and the IG at the FBI is highly respected. I mean, his
Yes, he is.
You know, people within and without the agency say, well, if this guy said it happened, then it probably did happen, regardless of what side of the aisle you find yourself on.
Right.
Does that feed the fire?
Of course.
Mr. Trump's fire? Because Mr. Trump, as you say, you know, unjustly accused the intel community of leaking this report.
Right.
It was on the street. But, you know, he sowed the seeds of doubt about the intel community from day one of his administration.
Absolutely, and he continues to do it, and that's one of the enduring themes in the book, Tom, where I talk about the erosion of institutions on which we depend today and will depend tomorrow. But on this particular case, and I know Jim Comey, and you made reference to the surveillance program earlier. I mean, Jim and I crossed swords in the spring of 2004, right? So we have a history in which we have not always agreed on things. But I always knew Jim to be honest and loyal, dedicated, always trying to do the right thing. Now, frankly, I agree with the IG report. I don't think Director Comey should have given either press conference with regard to the Clinton administration. But the sum total of that is that those press conferences probably helped, not hurt, Donald Trump. So I think I'd be careful if I were the president pushing that narrative. And the core judgment of the IG report is that political considerations did not enter into the investigation. So once again, you have the president not anchoring his speech on data or objective reality, but more or less throwing stuff against the wall to see what'll stick.
Speaking of the surveillance program, well, you're the director of the NSA. What is your response to the critics who argue that your oversight of this wiretapping program at the NSA and your testimony to Congress, your public statements about it, and you did write about it in your first book, Playing to the Edge, but that involvement somehow disqualifies you, of all people, to talk about the truth? This is what some of your critics are alleging.
Well, I mean, they can go ahead and allege. I told the truth to Congress. I told the truth to the public when this was going on, limited by what it was I was allowed to say. And so, therefore, as things were classified, I could not make them public. But I, to the best of my ability, answered questions with regard to what we were doing. And frankly, I was the fella who briefed Congress, a small group, admittedly, and that may have been a mistake. Perhaps we should have briefed more members of Congress, not just the Gang of Four or the Gang of Eight. But I was the one who briefed. And Tom, the folks at NSA will tell you, as I'm preparing for each of those briefings, I'm telling people, don't hold back. Don't pretend this is less than what it is. We need to be able to impress upon the audience, the members of Congress, what it is we were doing, so that at some future date when this becomes public, and we knew it was going to become public and going to be controversial, we didn't want them to be able to say, well, you know, I got some kind of briefing, but I'd had no idea. We did our very best to prevent that from happening, even though that is exactly what happened.
Let me press one other aspect of this point, and then we're going to take a little break.
Sure.
But there's a guy named Trevor Tim who's writing in the Columbia Journalism Review, who quotes you as saying the president of the United States doesn't have the authority to authorize electronic surveillance. That authority was taken away from him in the 1970s with the intelligence reforms of that era. The only institution of the U.S. government that can now authorize surveillance against a U.S. person is the United States court system. You know, Tim is saying that, you know, there were all sorts of, that first of all, that that's not true, that there's the president can put it in front of a FISA court, make it and make it so. You set up this program, again, it has to do with, you know, surveillance of people who were putatively talking to people internationally, so that at least one side of the call was on international borders, but there were some times, evidently, that both sides of the call were here in America. What is your explanation or your understanding of this now in the light of hindsight about how that may have affected people's, you know, the general public's understanding of the intelligence community and its veracity and its credibility?
So I've already commented on my view of my truth-telling, all right? And again, some programs are classified. You can't get into the fine print detail of what's going on out there. But I am quite content with what it is, certainly what I told Congress, and frankly, what I was able to tell the American public. In this particular case, Tom, under the FISA Act, all right, what you described is how you are allowed to target a U.S. person, not listen. I could really get into the obscure of signals intelligence law here. But, you know, when you're targeting a legitimate foreign target and he's speaking with an American, you're listening to an American. But that's not prohibited by law, Constitution, the FISA Act, or the president. That happens in the course of collecting foreign intelligence. Now, we did, after 9/11, the president exercised under his war-making authorities, his Article II authorities, the ability to target certain communications entering or leaving the United States, as you said, communications that were international in scope. And the view of the administration and the Department of Justice, and frankly, Jim Comey, this was not what he objected to, was that that was an appropriate use of the president's Article II authorities, and to the degree that FISA prevented that, it was an unconstitutional limitation on the president's authorities. And so those are complex issues, Tom, and I know we don't want to peel them all the way back, but let me also mention something additional, though, something that I learned, all right? The more you can be public, the more you can let the public know about what it is you're doing, not just the Congress, the better my community will be now and in the future. Because what's happened, Tom, is that back in the 70s, the handshake was, if you tell Congress, you've fulfilled your responsibility in terms of oversight. And now, because of a shift in American political culture, a lot of Americans, for a lot of reasons, not just intelligence, a lot of Americans, for a lot of reasons, are no longer willing to outsource their oversight of their government to their elected representatives. They want to know more themselves. We have to respond to that. We live inside the broader political culture. We don't shape or control it.
That's an excellent point, and this book makes a very compelling case, it's a great vehicle to inform our understanding of that. We're going to take a quick break. General Michael Hayden is my guest. He was the director of both the NSA and the CIA, as well as the first principal deputy director of National Intelligence. We're talking about his latest book, The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls and comments for General Hayden, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a little break from politics and public policy. We're going to do smart nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. We will have more politics later this week when Mayor Catherine Pugh spends the hour with me on Friday. A reminder that early voting is underway. Polls are open from 10 to 8 today, tomorrow, and Thursday. Election Day is a week from today. If you just joined us, my guest is General Michael Hayden. He's written a book that once again proves just how important elections are. It's called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. So, General, you make the point that one of the basic responsibilities of the intelligence community is to help the duly elected president succeed.
Right.
What does helping Donald Trump succeed mean?
So we have this challenge with every president, Tom, and I don't mean to pretend this isn't a challenge every time the American people speak their will, but by and large, the job of intelligence is to create the left and right-hand boundaries of logical policy discussion, rational deliberation, based upon objective external reality. Now, look, a lot of other things can enter into that. The president's instincts, the president's political priorities, opportunity costs, and so on. But again, the left and the right-hand boundaries based upon objective reality. And there's evidence, and actually some of the things going on along our borders demonstrates the case. There's evidence that the president's departure point for a lot of what he says and some of what he does isn't an agreed-upon view of objective reality, but something else. Instinct and a priori narrative of how he thinks the world works, or frankly, sometimes just raw campaign rhetoric. And so the job of intelligence is to try to impose those boundaries on the process and on the final decision.
Yesterday, we had the specter of Kirstjen Nielsen, Secretary of Homeland Security, twisting herself into pretzels, trying to justify or explain this policy that she insists is not a policy of specifically separating families at the southern border. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about when you title your book American National Security in an Age of Lies?
It is, and you know, Tom, the most difficult part of the book to write, or at least the one that had the most rewrites until I got it the way I felt most comfortable, was an extended passage on some people I know, really good people, H.R. McMaster, John Kelly, and others in the administration, who I hold in high regard, and we should all have a deep appreciation that they've gone into the administration to do the best they can. But how just being in the administration seems to compromise all that they have been up until this point. And not, yesterday, you had Secretary Nielsen there, whom I actually signed the letter supporting as Secretary of Homeland Security because of her magnificent record up to that point, doing the kinds of things that you just described. A friend of mine, John McLaughlin, who used to be acting director of Central Intelligence, John describes the pattern, and I quote this in the book, John describes the pattern as you create the lie, you repeat the lie often enough, and then good people end up defending the lie. And I think we've seen an awful lot of that in the administration. And in that section where I talk about these good people and my gratitude that they're still there, I end it pretty much with a question, Tom. These good folks, sooner or later, have to think about whether or not there's still a guardrail and whether or not their continued presence there simply legitimates or enables really bad courses of action.
A lot of people talk about the good people who are trying to make this administration work. They talk about the good people, the principled people in Congress and the Senate. Right. You mentioned General Kelly, whom you know, and who, you know, before he became...
And admire.
Before he became chief of staff, you know, had a long and very successful military career. But it was Mr. General Kelly who was one of the first people to adduce that this sort of tough love policy of keeping families separate would be a deterrent for immigration, both asylum seekers, which are legal people approaching border patrol agents and asking for refugee status, and people who come across the border without documents. At what point is that just a matter of a good person with a misguided policy idea, or is it something else?
So there's a lot going on, And so John did say that. He said it more than a year ago. He said it in March of 2017 when he was Secretary of Homeland Security. And look, when John Kelly talks about this, I listen, because you realize John's last job in the air, in the Marines, in the Armed Forces, was head of Southcom, which is our command responsible for everything south of Mexico. So John had a lot of personal knowledge about this. And so when he made that statement, it was something that I felt we should certainly consider, given John's background. Now, my conclusion was, no, you can't do that. There are a lot of things you can do to stop people coming across the border, to deter them, and we'll decide we're not going to go do that. I mean, let me be real extreme for a minute here, Tom. I've actually lived in several countries who make sure people don't cross their border by planting landmines. We're not going to do that. And I don't think we ought to do this either. And so I've got a serious policy debate with John, and I think he's wrong. But, you know, that's not even half the problem. The rest of the problem is the administration refusing to simply own up to the fact that this was their policy decision. They've just obfuscated it in such a way as to try to avoid any responsibility. So it's one thing to support a policy and be wrong. It's quite another and far more destructive of the institutions of government and faith in government to just continually lie about that which you are obviously doing.
And that does become a sideshow to the, or at the moment, the main event in a conversation about the fact that the law allows the administration to do exactly what it's doing. I mean, Secretary Nielsen is correct in that regard.
Oh, yes.
The law, they're not breaking any laws doing this now.
No, they're not.
The president tries to say that it's the Democrats who made the law, which is just absurd on its face. But you know, it is the current law.
The current law both allows them to do this, and if they do certain other things, seems to compel them to do this, which is why the last two administrations refused to do this. And so the triggering event, that which is different, is a policy decision on the part of the administration. And frankly, let me make it even worse, a policy decision on the part of the administration to, I think, hold the children hostage to, one, deter people from crossing the border, but two, to pressure, leverage the American Congress to give the president his wall.
Yeah, the wall that Mexico was going to pay for, according to campaign rhetoric.
You know, Tom, too, I mentioned earlier that there have been three episodes now with regard to our borders where we have based decisions on something other than objective reality. The first was the first week of the administration with the executive order that was genuinely a Muslim ban and is still being contested in the courts.
We might have a decision about that as early as tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah. The second was the truly hyping of the threat to America from several busloads of Guatemalan mothers and their kids coming up through Mexico, hyped to such an extent by friendly news media that we actually remilitarized our southern border. And now we're painting what's happening on our southern border as such an apocalyptic danger to the United States. You know, desperate times require desperate measures. All of those are objectively incorrect. But the language, the using something other than objective reality as your departure point is the justification for these extreme measures that are not only wrong, but seem to erode who it is we are.
General Michael V. Hayden, his book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. Let's see if we can take a couple of calls. We'll start with Herman in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with General Hayden.
Hi, everybody. General Hayden, I like a lot of what you're saying these days. Question, how did the multi-billion-dollar American intelligence establishment miss the rise of ISIS? And also, how did they miss the Sunni counterattack that came after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and George Bush's mission accomplished statement?
All right, thanks for the call, Herman.
Thanks, Herman. Yeah, great questions and complex issues. So the first thing, Herman, I guess this is my throwing myself on the mercy of the court. The American intelligence community doesn't get any easy questions. I was director of CIA for about a year, I was talking to a group of prominent Americans, and one of the individuals said, "General, on a scale of 0 to 10, how would you rate CIA analysis?" And I quickly responded, "Now you realize, sir, we don't do 8, 9, or 10. If we can get something to 8, 9, or 10, they're asking the Department of Commerce or something. They're not asking us." So the first thing, Herman, I want to press upon you, these are difficult things. Your first question was ISIS. Frankly, I think we were so focused on the tactical, operational, daily needs of beating down al-Qaeda. And here I'm talking about targeted killings and raids and so on, that we had our heads so down in the scope looking at destroying the last remnants of al-Qaeda that we just didn't pay enough attention. And the way I put it is, we were so busy cutting down these last trees over here of al-Qaeda that we didn't notice the second growth forest that was growing over here that became ISIS. And so I think the intel guys were late to warning the Obama administration. And Herman, there's another definite reality out there. When you're telling a policymaker something that cuts across, cuts against his policy, his preferences, or his politics, you got to build a strong case, and it takes a lot of time. So I think both intel and policy were late there. With regard to what the Sunnis did in Iraq, that was more or less in the policy lane. The agency did warn quite robustly that Iraq was a fractured society, and to remove centralized control, even evil centralized control like Saddam Hussein, could unleash centripetal forces that were going to be hard to control. So I'll take the hit for the ISIS thing, more extenuation with regard to the civil war that erupted in Iraq.
And General, you talk in the book about the Obama administration's apparent disdain for much of the Washington foreign policy establishment, and yeah. You say that Trump doubled down on it.
Yeah,
that these may be the only place where there's an intersection of agreement there. He calls it a deep state. What does this mean? Given the fact that the community, the intelligence community, did miss ISIS by most accounts, Lord knows what we're missing now with a president who is resistant to virtually any input from the intelligence or foreign policy establishment.
So I admire the folks who are still there. I can only imagine what it must be like in the Oval, where I used to deliver some briefings every morning. With regard to a president, and I'm trying to be really fair here, Tom, the president is the way God made him. He follows his instincts. Rather than some data stream that some stranger tries to put in front of him. And so that means that my old guys have to accommodate as best they can to how this president learns, how this president thinks, how this president decides. And again, I admire them for doing the work that they're doing. But as the tone of the book that you've already displayed tries to point out, I'm really worried, because there are an awful lot of instances when the president seems to have said or done something and the departure point wasn't objective reality. It was rhetoric or instinct or overconfidence.
Before we take a break, General, you quote a conservative ethicist named Peter Weiner, who says that beliefs are really tied up with identities. And if changing your beliefs means changing your identity, then it comes at the risk of rejection from the community of people with whom you share that identity. And you talk about how Mr. Trump has driven the discussion, the political discourse, to the edges, both the left and the right, and it's denuded the center. That's not your word, but the center is vanishing because the conversations are so tied up with identity and belief on either side of the spectrum. What's the way forward from there?
So, Tom, you bring up a great point and something I really try to emphasize in the book, and I made a brief allusion to this earlier, that the president was effect, not cause. The overall cause of this is the movement of our culture and our political culture into this post-truth world. And so we might want to spend a little bit of time when we come back talking about the larger dynamics there, that the president as candidate, brilliantly recognized and then exploited. And now as president, I think, makes even worse. But Peter's quote is exactly right. With the erosion of other institutions, and David Brooks from the New York Times mentioned this as well, and I refer to him in the book too, as people have moved away from other institutions, church, family, social organizations, the Elks, the American Legion, and so on, they now seem to wrap up their personal identity with their political beliefs. And so when I go to the back room of a bar in Pittsburgh, and I talk about this in the book, and talk to my old friends who are all supporters of President Trump, and I try to bring facts to the conversation, facts are not particularly useful to dissuade someone from a position that was not originally based on facts. And that's where we are with a lot of our positions. Tom, by a margin of 55 to 35, people who self-identify as Republicans support what's going on the southern border. That's what I'm talking about.
My guest for the hour today is General Michael Hayden. His new book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. Quick break. When we come back, we'll take more of your questions and comments. We're going to talk about Russia. We're going to talk about those facts that General Hayden referred to and how Russia has been helping all sorts of people manipulate them in all sorts of interesting ways. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is General Michael Hayden. His new book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. General Hayden's career in the military and intelligence spans more than 40 years. He writes about the multifaceted branches of the intelligence community. The FBI handles counterintelligence. The CIA concerns itself with human intelligence and analysis. The NSA deals with intercepted communications. And the Director of National Intelligence, the DNI, provides overall leadership. General Hayden has written a scathing critique of the Trump administration's lack of understanding of the geopolitical challenges facing the United States and our allies. He points in particular to the consequences for intelligence and security of the president's refusal to acknowledge Russia's meddling in our elections and their attempts to degrade our democratic comity and institutions. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. So General Hayden, I do want to talk about Russia. And you basically make the point that Trump would say something on the campaign trail and Russia would amplify it.
Right.
That Russia would use wedges. You talk about the NFL scandal or the situation with people not standing for the national anthem and the words they use, the terms that they put out there in the Twittersphere, the number of times they repeat particular words that are designed to divide people, that are designed to have those folks you write about in the back of the bar in Pittsburgh be at odds with, frankly, many of the listeners of this program, probably. So explain, if you could, and it some caps away the scope of what Russia was able to do in 2016 and what you think perhaps they may be capable of doing in this next election coming up just in November.
Sure. Now, so Tom, I describe this thing is kind of a three-layer cake, with the biggest layer at the base being you and me and the culture within which we exist. And obviously the biggest layer is the most important. The second layer is the administration and the president. And the third layer, which is frankly the smallest, is the Russians. Because the Russians are recognizing what's going on in layer one and layer two, and they are exploiting it for their own purposes. Their purpose being to divide, distract, and weaken us, because they cannot compete with us head to head. They are no longer a great power. And by the way, they try this technique, social media and other means, to divide societies around the world. They just aren't as successful everywhere as they are here. They tried this game against Norway, but it doesn't work because the Norwegians aren't fractured the way we are fractured. So back again, layers one and two, the most important layers. You mentioned the NFL take a knee controversy, Tom, and that's a classic. And I pointed out in great detail in the book, but the executive summary is the president goes to Alabama in late September, makes a speech to, it's a political speech, it's more or less a campaign rally, and he criticizes the NFL, number one, for rule changes to prevent head injuries. He doesn't appeal to our better angels. And then goes after the SOBs, except he doesn't use letters, who won't stand for the anthem. Before he gets back to the East Coast on Air Force One, Russian botnets, so Russian computer networks controlled by an organization in St. Petersburg, their leading hashtags are NFL, take a knee, and showing you sometimes it's hard to make the translation quickly, take the knee, bombarding American social media with this theme. And Tom, they're on both ends. Tastes great, less filling, so to speak. They're playing the patriotic end and they're playing the free speech end because they don't have a dog in the fight other than to make us fight. And then that theme, those themes get picked up by American alt-right media, InfoWars, Gateway Pundit, Alex Jones. They take the controversy pretty racial pretty quickly because of the demographics of the NFL. And then that not the racial part, but the controversy then shows up on Fox News, usually through Sean Hannity, but it bleeds elsewhere within the Fox News family. And then the president watches it on a weekday morning and tweets his approval of it. And there you've got this unvirtuous circle. None of that, Tom, is collusion. I call it convergence because everybody does what they do for their own purposes. The president feeds the base. The Russians mess with our heads. The alt-right, they're conspiratorial anyway. Fox News feeds the demographics and gets better ratings. But the sum total of it is to drive bigger wedges inside American society, including within my own extended family, who have people yelling at one another on the phone over this issue. And to drive home the point, Tom, this is before the bye weekend start, and so all 32 teams are playing. And the Sunday before the Huntsville, Alabama speech, of the 1,750 American athletes who suited up for the NFL, a total of six did anything other than stand at attention for the anthem. This is not a national crisis, but there you have all the ingredients, those three layers of the cake playing together actually harm American comedy.
Yeah, you use the example that hashtag take a knee was used as a hashtag nearly 800 times and other related hashtags used 600 times on other occasions. So, and you say this was a very interesting point to me. You say this goes back 20 years and that the Russians have gotten very good at invading and dominating the American information space,
right,
whereas we, the United States, stuck with what you call door number one, which was cyber dominance, right?
Right.
So they opted for information dominance. We opted for cyber dominance. And you even give the Trump administration fairly decent marks for their handling of cyber security.
But, you bet.
But boy, the information space, I mean, do you think they chose the right door?
Oh, they did. Now, I tell a story of myself. Back in the 90s, I come out of the war in the Balkans as a two-star and take command of an Air Force unit, big unit, 17,000 people, that's on the cutting edge of things cyber. And I recount in the book, Tom, we had an argument amongst ourselves that, you know, medieval theologians would have been jealous of our intensity. And we were arguing whether we were in the cyber business, you know, computer network stuff, or more broadly in the information business. And we decided that, number one, cyber was hard enough, and the information bubble over here with deception, public diplomacy, public affairs, that was just too complicated. And oh, by the way, you can't really play in that circle very much in the United States without hitting your shins on the First and the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So we stayed over here in the cyber lane. And as you suggest, the Russians, under the leadership of a man who is now the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, They went to door number two, and if you read Gerasimov's doctrinal writings, he talks about contactless warfare using informational means against the target population of an adversary state. And that's precisely what the Russians have done against us and some others.
We have an email from John, and General, I'll admit that I'd never thought about this particular possibility. Ask the General if a United Nations sent a force into the United States in order to free the children on the southern border, would it be justified as a use of force?
I would say no, but you know what? That's not as crazy a question as it might seem. And look, that's never going to happen, all right? Because we are a self-governing society. Our institutions of government, not yet anyway, broken down. But you know, Tom, I've had the thought. If what we were doing on the southern border was being done by the Turks or the Jordanians with regard to Syrian refugees who were fleeing violence, like the people in Texas are, we would have joined consensus in the Security Council at the United Nations condemning what they were doing. So the core of the question brings up a really interesting point.
General Michael Hayden is my guest. Howard in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with General Hayden.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask the general if he thinks that part of the difficulty today is that our foundation document and our foundation myth is false and not based in fact. So our foundation myth is based on the statement that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are here to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Self-evident statements are not subject to factual analysis. And over the last several days on NPR, there's been statements about logical thinking and scientific thinking. This statement suggests that all of our opinions are equally valid. And I wanted to ask the general if he thinks that our present difficulty dates to that logical flaw.
Interesting question, Howard, and I suggested to Tom already that I really got out of my circle and talked to philosophers and historians of philosophy and so on. And so the way I look at the question you're raising, our foundational documents, which I actually talk a fair amount about in the book, is that the foundational documents were actually written by students and disciples of the Enlightenment. And this post-truth world is actually a rejection of Enlightenment values in which decisions were supposed to be made on evidence, hypothesis, test, adjustment, humility in the face of complexity, and so on. And so when America moves into a post-truth environment, it really does undercut the basic core fuel, oil, whatever metaphor that works for you, of how it is it's supposed to work here. Now, you get now to the question of expertise, where obviously I should respect the opinion of every person, but it does not necessarily follow that every opinion deserves the same space, the same respect, the same influence on decision making. Tom Nichols, whom I quote in the book, and I've read Tom's book with regard to the death of expertise. Tom quotes a professor having an argument over some matters of astrophysics with a student, and the student ends up with, well, I guess we disagree. Your guess is as good as mine. And the astrophysicist says, actually, that's not true. My guess is actually better than yours. And that's part of the broad issue we have here as a democratic people, as a people who respect everyone's right to have a view. That seems to have moved into a darker place where we actually attack and disregard expertise, and so that something other than data, instinct, preference, grievance, now becomes a legitimate base for decision. Look, the president does this. Tom, let me tell this one because it's a very telling episode.
And I'm going to have to ask you to keep it to about 10 seconds because we're running out of time. I'm sorry.
Look, the president believes things are true if he can make them trending. They're true enough for him if he can make them popular. That's the issue.
General Michael Hayden, his latest book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. General, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much for this provocative
Thank you.
Book. Appreciate it. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagel. And looking ahead on Friday, it's Midday with the Mayor. Mayor Catherine Pugh will join me in Studio A for the hour, and I hope you can join us every day for Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. It was on this day, June 19th, 1865, 2 months after the end of the Civil War, that black slaves in Galveston, Texas, got the news that the South had surrendered and that the war was over. Happy Juneteenth, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.